So I want to present our submission, co-authored myself, Philip Winter, and Roya. And what I'm going to do as quickly as possible, bearing in mind that there is a wide set of array of issues and sort of subjects that's going to come up in the course of this conversation, is I want to outline first a short history of measurement, a particularly distorted one, perhaps to fit my purposes, but factually kind of correct. From there, we're going to try to begin to describe that filtering regimes are more heterogeneous than previously described, then explore this principle based off of two case studies, starting to look at the diversity of filtering practices that happen within a single country. Then from there, outline suggested principles for network measurements based off of these situations, and then summarize with a well-warranted discussion on ethics and measurement shortcomings that are broadly applicable across the wide set of projects that have developed in the past years. This will also be known in French as an auto-da-fé. Okay, I got a couple. So once upon a time, there was a site called Blocked in Iran, which was one of the primary resources that journalists used for writing on freedom of expression issues in Iran. Blocked in Iran, as you might expect, had a couple of issues. First off, the platform was secretly just a curl request through an open proxy within the telecommunications company of Iran, which happens to also be one of the primary sources of Iranian information controls. This has been documented last year very well, actually, by University of Michigan. So there's a couple of interesting things, but one might suspect that essentially what it looks for is a 403 error code to determine whether a URL is unblocked. While this might have worked years ago, such an approach became problematic when the TCI shifted last year to a dual stack strategy using DNS redirection and HTTP inspection. So in this case, actually, from a couple of days ago, we see that apparently, according to the site, YouTube is not blocked in Iran. However, actually, YouTube is very blocked in Iran and has been for 5 years. The problem is for this, most likely, the DNS tampered page returns a 200 error code, and so therefore it reads a bit wrong. So what do we learn from this? This presents the first nightmare, which is a single-sourced platform with unclear origins of data doing one test with narrow validation, which is also easily findable by the authorities that you're trying to essentially measure. So this presents a problem. And this is resemblant of, I think, what you had was the first generation of censorship measurement and conversations, which was to say, this was the documentation of early and highly aggressive states that interfered with information controls at the international gateway. Because this was interesting, and because they were first, and because in some ways it was a little more easy. And the results of these studies often came out as essentially measurement from one location per ISP, per country, every once in a while. And so this is a model, I suppose. But the problem is that, for one, this model was rarely bound to political or cultural events that may trigger changes in practices. Essentially, they often assumed that these sorts of filtering practices were more or less unchanging. However, what has happened in the past couple of years, quite easy to see, is that there has been a shifting norm in filtering. Essentially, politicians and international organizations, or such as intellectual property rights organizations, have promoted filtering as a way of protecting economic or social interests. And also, there is a very large industry represented by trade conferences such as ISS World that have put on a concerted effort to push surveillance and filtering equipment into networks. Also, there is a fair amount of evidence that in some cases there's public acceptance of filtering practices, especially when it comes to child protection. So what you have, or let's say our assumptions are, is that you have now increasingly heterogeneous filtering regimes, which is that filtering will be more of a legal compliance effort, such as in mirroring kind of data retention rules, where a telecommunications company is forced to take on filtering for their own. So we should anticipate that with this practice, there will be greater diversity in the timing and strategies that are implemented by third parties. So filtering is a lot more likely in the average country to look like essentially this chart, which is the order from the Turkish High Court for the blocking of Twitter. So we can quickly get past this just for the sake of time, but that is to say that also there's been sort of a reciprocal pushback in terms of research and detection methodologies, of which several of the people are the co-authors or developers here, so I don't need to. However, the key principle that we want to keep in mind that I think stimulates this paper is that the majority of the practices are not happening at scale or are currently in development. And by scale, again, I mean multiple points of measurement, multiple times in multiple countries over multiple tests. There are only probably about two tests that may directly or indirectly detect measurement or network interference that are deployed at scale, and I would say that those are the NDT test, Glasnost, and Netalyzer. But still, they're mostly, most tools are one ISP, one network, once in a while. So for our purposes, if we want to start to look at what are the methodologies and the sort of practices that we can see based off of the next generation, we turn to the RIPE Atlas network. The RIPE Atlas network are a set of physical devices that are distributed around the world. For our purposes, they're highly there's a high geographic proliferation across a diversity of types of networks, consumer networks, private networks, probably even governmental networks. They have a moderate amount of measurements that you can perform, ping, traceroute, DNS resolution, SSL cert fetching. They're very stable over time, particularly in compared to volunteers. I think a lot of people have probably dealt with the issue of volunteers. And you also get push-based measurement rules. And so you get a very responsive platform. The minute you need something, it's going to be there. So this is about as close as we can get to right now deployment or testing of an ideal case measurement platform. So what we want to do is essentially push the mode of operation from this, which is sort of approximate model of several of the papers, the way that global practices of filtering have occurred, where it's essentially a country, a practice, a couple of practice witness, and a range of time that's never repeated, into something that is looks a lot more like this. Bearing in mind that essentially network measurement is hard, it's in flux, and you need longitudinal data. You need very granular data in order to really look at the picture that I think is interesting, especially from a scientific or policy point of view. So we're going to try to apply this to two cases and very small subsets of the data that we were able to collect. The first being actually the case of Turkey. Essentially, in March, social media users began to report limitations on the accessibility of Twitter across Turkey's internet service providers. YouTube and Twitter had both become the target of condemnation by the Prime Minister, now President Erdogan, mostly because other factions were using this in order to post leaked documents and recordings, the biggest ones having to do with corruption charges and national security leaks, especially about relationships with Syrian jihadists. So previously, and according to prior research, especially the things that I modeled, Turkey's internet filtering had been characterized as DNS tampering and port block IP blocking, which both fall into the measurement purview of Atlas. So upon news of the first blocking of Twitter, we essentially said, okay, what would we expect based off of the political situation? To the best of our knowledge, especially none of us being well-versed in Turkey, what do we apply, or what should we start to look for? And so we started to look for SSL connectivity, DNS answers, traceroute reachability for sites like Twitter, YouTube public DNS, Google public DNS, and the Tor project. We got about 10 probes covering 9 ASN, so we have, I think, a greater diversity of measurements than you typically get in this type of research. We didn't try to look at specific content controls. We just wanted to look for the big platforms that are particularly controversial. Again, for the purpose of time, I'm just going to take a subset of history, which is the case of Google public DNS. Because this is really interesting. Because it actually was primarily a DNS blocking, Turkish civil society groups had previously run concerted educational efforts to get people to switch to international DNS servers as a way of circumventing the ban. At that time, the 8888 address of Google Public DNS had become essentially a political statement. And this is also, it's also interesting to note, and this will come up, I think, a little later in the ethics section, is that according to some research, actually, the Turkish population, the adoption rate of Google Public DNS had been somewhere in the order of 20% of the population. So what you had was you had a very publicly visible case of the population circumventing the ban, and the public media, international media, picked up on this and used this as a way of sort of denigrating the actions and saying Erdogan looked weak and that the people were bypassing it and people, you know, like all of these sort of aphorisms that we sort of come to hold true but are actually false and kind of silly about the way that internet censorship works. This became a point of pressure. So the first thing that happened, right? So about March 21st, this gets blocked. Or Twitter gets blocked about March 20th. About March 21st, people are just graffitiing 888 everywhere. The international media starts to call attention. And so this is what actually originally from our subset or a subset of our probes, the traceroute paths to Google Public DNS look like. You have essentially three visible transits out of the country, and then hitting all directly probably paired with Google or something else, and then hitting 8888. So in about 1 a.m. GMT, what happens is Turkish Telecom port blocks Google Public DNS. This happens for about 6 hours. And ostensibly, probably what happened was people realized, oh, a lot of people's internet just broke and they have no clue how to change the DNS settings back. And so this is not the way of going about it, especially when we can do something much easier, which is actually Twitter's IP addresses are all sitting within the same /24. We can just block those IP addresses and it doesn't matter what the answer they get anyways. So that works. Five hours after blocking, they unblock Google Public DNS. About 4 hours after that, they block Twitter by actually just by specifically port, not even address. So they do it very narrowly, as I recall. Interesting to see, however, that one ISP still gets connectivity out. This is a business-aligned ISP. It's has VSAT and other sort of connections, but you know, if we want to take this as sort of at sometimes a fail fest to say this is when we would have things could have gone wrong, if I had just had my measurement perspective inside of that ISP, I would have thought, oh, connectivity is all good, we can move on. So service is eventually restored, and we get the same transit out as we did before. However, about March 27th, YouTube gets blocked, particularly with the release of a leaked phone call with Erdogan claiming that they were going to arrange a false flag operation as far as an act of terrorism in order to invade Syria. So YouTube gets blocked by name, but actually, and to do the bad thing of backing up, actually, so you can't see this, especially if you're colorblind, I'm sorry. This green is YouTube accessibility. And so what we see is YouTube supposedly gets blocked on the 27th, but actually about 60% of the probes can still connect because they have 8888 or they have other means. So in March 28th, what happens is all of a sudden these probes start getting the false answers and the connectivity plummets to zero. What has happened, according to Traceroute, and then independently confirmed by somebody getting a looking glass lookup in the middle of Turkish Telecom, is that Turkish Telecom has done a very narrow BGP hijack on Google Public DNS's IP addresses and potentially open DNS's, and redirected it to a DNS server inside of the country, which is now returning the same false answers that the other domestic servers are. Of course, we still have the one business ISP that's still connected, plugging away fine, and getting connectivity. So this is interesting, and it's actually well documented. But by having a diversity of viewpoints, you start to see something even more interesting. All of a sudden, ISPs start to defect and get transit over an alternative gateway. And so one day later, actually, an ISP, I can't speak Turkish, I'm not even going to try, but an ISP starts to get transit through Euroweb, which is actually, incidentally, for what it's worth, owned by Turkish Telecom, but apparently is not administering a BGB hijack, has a clean route out. And so this ISP decides to start transiting out. I don't have the BGP data. I'm not going to try to, you know, say what the intent is, the actual mechanism, but that is to say, it got real answers. It had a valid route out. 2 days later, another ISP defects. And so what you have is you have an interesting sort of contestation of authority by the ISPs whose customers are probably just, quite frankly, pissed. This goes on until eventually April 7th when connectivity is stored, especially when Google calls them out. So the first lesson is that actually the more that you have wide-scale data sets, the more that you have a complex picture that shows you things that are happening that you wouldn't otherwise expect, but you also get validation. And so that is to say, if we anticipate that ISPs or governments don't coordinate their responses to filtering or surveillance or things like that, then what we get is we get answers that are very narrowly tailored within geographic or ISP network subsets. This is interesting because I would argue that, and that this allows us to start building consensus-based pools of what valid answers are, or at least interesting and aberrant answers. So we can look at things like what the SSL host name is, whether the certificate validates, what are the end transit providers that we see, what's the timing for the network route, where are obviously fake answers, and these sorts of things. And then we can compare them across countries, across networks, and we can see where things start to pin out. So what we can do, mindful of time, is we can actually apply this in the case of Russia. So especially in February, what we saw, and this has already been noted, is we saw the aggressive escalation of restrictions on blogs. This is Alexei Navalny's blog. This is a country just like Turkey that has a diverse frontier unlike China or Syria. So there's not a direct intervention. There's a compliance regime. To skip forward, beginning in March, the Federal Service for Supervision in Telecommunications and Mass Communications orders the blacklisting of opposition figure blogs and media portals, as we've noted, Alexei Navalny's blog. So we can look at, for example, we see a diversity across the frontier. When we look at the case of opposition media portals, we see that there's actually different responses according to Backbone, according to ISP. A random sample of 255 probes across 147 ASs in Russia, only 38 probes out in 20 ASs received aberrant DNS answers for the media portal Grani. Is that how I pronounce it? Grani? Grani.io. A greater selection, 40 probes on 23 ASs on port 80 stop somewhere in Russian space. So we can ascribe a lot of the ways in which blocking would occur. Because this is Atlas, we don't have HTTP requests. We can imagine that a substantial more of those HTTP requests were intercepted by some middle box. Even more interesting, though, is the case of Alexei Navalny's blog. In contrast, on 255 probes, we receive a consistent reply of the IP address 208.93.0.190. This is important, which matches internationally with only internationally across Ukraine, across other regional states, with only one anonymous response, a formerly valid address. So the blocking of Alexei Navalny's blog must be different, and we can see this again because we have diversity. So on April 28th, 78 out of 343 Russian probes returned either irregular responses or failed to connect to this LiveJournal address. 40 probes on 29 ASs actually return SSL certificates with common names and locations attributed to Russian ISP. Based off of these certificates and HTTP ecosystem scans, we can also say that whatever this box is actually on the .90 address. This is actually a fairly recently opened up server. So the invalid certificates indicate that an intermediary in transit has probably redirected traffic out of its expected path to a third-party server controlled by Russian entities. This is different from the normal man-in-the-middle injection responses seen in countries such as Iran and Syria. And so I don't do a good job of contrasting it, but what we see is essentially Rostelecom is intercepting this address. There's not a transparent middle box that's examining host names or examining a protocol. Something is just doing wholesale IP layer redirection. This happens for ICMP, this happens for UDP, and as well as for TCP traceroutes. So there's whole-scale redirection. But what's interesting is if we take another IP address, it works, it's fine. We have valid international routes, we have a diversity of transit across frontiers. You see some of these ISPs that were going through Rostelecom are now not. I'm not saying it's BGP, I'm not asserting a mechanism, I'm saying that there's some sort of interaction. So, wow, I'm running. Here's why this is interesting. In fact, there's a common theme with this IP address that we start to learn through the data that we collect. When Navalny's site was blocked, it had this 190 address. However, for other IP addresses, or other banned LiveJournal, we see always, when they're banned, an address that ends in .190. However, we can go through historical data sets, and we find that, in fact, by a weird coincidence, many of those blogs, we can find records that say that they had an alternative address. And if we go through Alexa's top 1 million, of the 1,460 live journals that are in there, 1,450 resolved to another address, this 150 address. We find only four addresses in the Alexa top 1 million live journal addresses that resolved to this 190 address. So our hypothesis is that essentially all the blogs, and we see all the blogs that have that are found on this alternative host have been publicly declared by Russian authorities as in violation of the law for promotion of political activities or extremism, and two, at least easily, are found in filtered site addresses. We suspect that essentially LiveJournal maintains an alternative server that is functionally the same as the main server in order to facilitate blocking by Russian authorities. We can check. The SSL certs are the same. The content is easily retrievable. And so what we believe is that there's a compliance mechanism where it moves it off so that it's not subject to the interference mechanism.
Could it be just a business decision about compliance?
So the problem with that is that LiveJournal is primarily owned by a Russian entity at this point. And that's sort of like a indirect answer, but I think it maybe aligns with that. And actually what we see is that this has aggressively escalated since the publication of the paper. There are substantially more LiveJournal addresses that are blocked now, and it's always the .90 address. So I'll be done in 3 minutes. So what we learn is controls are ephemeral and issued without forewarning. Push-based rules allow us to be responsive to ephemeral events such as the Turkey blocking. Validation requires a network client identification. We have to normalize our data, because otherwise, in the case of Turkey, people use 8888 not as a circumvention mechanism, but because it's easy and generally it's probably like everyone's using 888 here, unless they're using whatever they get from DHCP or they're super elite, unlike me. However, what you would get is if you're relying on probes or clients or volunteers that were using 888, there would have been no censorship until the DNS hijacking. So proper measurement requires documentation about the setup. This data collection should also be longitudinal and frequent over a normal interval. For example, to be able to show how the changes in the LiveJournal ecosystem have potential ramifications for policy, for the usability of the platform, or whether there's some sort of cooperation between LiveJournal and the Russian authorities. Idiosyncrasies in host networks requires normalization because you find a lot of things that you have to be able to infer whether SSL is disrupted because it's the date of a protest or because the point of view that you're using is behind an onerous corporate firewall. Ethics is hard. Atlas wasn't designed as a censorship detection platform, but the terms of service doesn't give us any guidance. On the one hand, looking at Facebook is, you know, Facebook might be banned. However, even something as innocuous as dictionary.com is going to be making DNS requests and making fetches to Facebook, Twitter, everything that we want to measure solely because they've included a like button. And then Alexei Navalny's site at the time, before it was blocked, was a top 1,000 site, top 100s in Russia. Tor project had 70,000 users, daily users at the height when we were measuring the SSL. So I guess our point is that these are piecemeal attempts to justify our targets, but they aren't a systemic framework, and we can't give answers as to what the systemic framework can be. We can only just say, we believe that there's enough collateral traffic, that this is, and this is not child pornography, and so therefore we do not believe that this is going to run the risk of having the probe operators under trouble. But we acknowledge that this is a problem. And essentially that ultimately we come up with widespread proliferation of measurements presents its own data validation model that within heterogeneous filtering regimes, you should expect greater diversity in implementation, including cheating and slow deployment. This is also important because if you find an ISP is faster to the draw than anyone, this gives civil society forewarning about increasing information controls. And you can push out things like updates to circumvention tools or educational material before platforms are shut down. And then ultimately, at least ethics issues aside, Atlas does provide us an early look at what the opportunities and impediments ahead for pervasive measurement detection present. But we acknowledge our lingering ethical concerns, and the availability of measurement types does limit some of our ability to make assertions about the nature of the networks that we're measuring. All right, you have 3.5 minutes to raise ethics. Yeah.
It's not clear to me that you show data supporting the second point. And actually, I wanted to ask about the second point.
Sure.
Is diversity in implementation increasing or decreasing? You know, you've shown that there is a lot of diversity.
Yeah.
But one could envision that diversity increasing, or one could imagine that being just a temporary, a glitch as the governments finally get it together and force all their ISPs to go to send everything through the same government sensor cloud, right?
I think that's fair, and I think that in fact to that point that you've seen situations, especially like Russia or Turkey, for example, where there's been a desire for increased coordination. All I can say more definitively is to say that in states in which censorship or filtering is happening at the international gateway, those are largely homogeneous regimes. Especially, there's been a lot of papers that look at the Great Firewall, and this situation is substantially more heterogeneous. And so I think I can definitively say that at this point in time, that where you have diversity in the international frontier, diversity in the gateways, and perhaps even just states who are caught off guard and don't understand exactly what they're losing without proper information controls, there is diversity. Or there is substantially more diversity towards this previous case. I can't say whether it's increasing or decreasing, but I'm saying within this model, this is what opportunities present themselves.
Increases or decreases,
I'm glad you ask, because I feel that this probably fits with number three. And that's exactly it. We don't have proper longitudinal data as it exists. And within that, we can't say. And longitudinal data does not just need to be sort of we ran tests, but we have to be running the same set of tests with the same parameters and collecting them in, I would argue, as open of a fashion as possible so they don't die on our desk. I think that's the best I can answer that question, and I appreciate it. So that's an interesting breakdown that I don't think that I can easily answer. But this is to say that I think measurement analysis is highly contextual and that targeting is highly contextual. But I think that the proliferation of massive data sets makes the former possible. And I can't give percentages, but I think that those two are intertwined and very important together. I don't think I'm properly answering your question. Can you ask it again?
Do you have thoughts on that generally?
Actually, so I think that the methodology, this presentation is contrary to the recommendations, which is to say what I've done is I've done a network measurement. We've done measurement network measurement that was very bound to contextual events. And that because it was bound to contextual events and it did not exist already, therefore, I have no longitudinal data, and to be honest, I have not continued to collect data since, we have not continued since the paper. And so I think that that's bad methodology, and I think that good methodology for network detection is actually agnostic to the political situation, although it would be good to prioritize or increase or to define targets based off of contextual knowledge. But I think that the analysis is heavily reliant, and only good analysis is reliant on contextual knowledge in order to piece out what's going on. Like, for example, the LiveJournal example doesn't make nearly as much sense until you start to realize that LiveJournal is owned by a Russian company and that half of the staff apparently quit 2 years ago because they were frustrated with the decisions that were made about compliance. Yeah. Thank you.